financial literacy, and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rayum.
Hi, it's Frances. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Rayum. Hi.
Hi, Jess. How's it going?
It's good. We're working on getting our setup all worked out, and I think it's good now.
It looks good. Your new studio looks good. I'm happy to have you here. Yeah.
All right. What are we talking about this week?
Well, can you believe we're talking about student loans again? Boy, it's a problem that just doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. So not just student loans in general, but student loans that are on any sort of income-driven plan, whether it's the SAVE plan or it's income-based repayment or any of these income-based plans, right? Now, for those people who might not be aware of that, when you graduate and you have a pile of student loans that you can't afford, one of the things that you can qualify for is some sort of income-driven plan on federal loans. That means that your payments are capped at a certain percentage of your income. Okay.
Okay.
So without being biased about this, one would think that sounds kind of fair, at least initially, right? That, you know, you can't pay at all and your options are, I can't afford this payment, so I go into default, mm-hmm. or I make some sort of payment arrangement. This is not any different than what people do with their credit cards or their mortgages or anything else when they have too much debt and they cannot afford to pay. Mm-hmm. Other than that, student loans are not eligible for a bankruptcy. Now, you know what I'm going to say. I'm not an attorney, and there are some cases where they might be eligible for bankruptcy. But in general, the school of thought is student loans don't qualify to be discharged in bankruptcy. So this is a difficult thing. I can complain for a long time, but I'll try not to, about how little education we give people when they're taking out these student loans mm-hmm. about what they will cost at graduation. So people have an idea, boy, it's going to cost me $80,000, $100,000, $300,000 to get my degree. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they have a clear idea of not just what the payment will be on that amount of debt, although most times people don't remember that they were ever told a payment if they were, but what havoc that wreaks in your finances when you graduate. It seems like there's this idea that you go to school, you rack up the debt. You know, most people are trying not to work their way through school now, or parents are trying to have their children not work their way through school because they want them to focus on their studies. Mm-hmm. And I keep wanting to say at retirement, but at graduation, they are handed their student debt and said, you have about 6 months of forbearance, maybe a year, where you can kind of float and figure out what you're doing and go get a job. Mm-hmm. So the job will be entry level because you've just graduated. Even if it's in a high paying field, your job may or may not be enough to pay your student loans. Now, people would say, well, what do you mean they're student loans? Yeah, well, they still have to rent a place to live or buy a house, drive a car, or pay for public transportation. They need to do frivolous things like, oh, I don't know, eat, right?
Well, yeah, and also the timing of it, too. Like, normally, you know, when you get out of college, that's when you're going to find all that stuff because you've been living in a dorm or probably at home with your parents. I know some people have apartments or houses before that. But, yeah, it's like everything hits all at once when you graduate.
There's no doubt about it. And this is why so many students end up home on mom and dad's couch, mm-hmm. right? Because they can't make ends meet. So student loans are a big part of that. But what's going to get your last dollar? Is it going to be your groceries? Probably not. You're going to prioritize that, right? Your groceries are going to come first. You need to eat. You need to pay your rent. You probably need to make your car payment if you're driving a car to and from work, right? Yeah. But the last thing on the list is your student loans. Mm-hmm. And so if you can afford them, that's great. You start making payments. If you can't, you make payment arrangements. And those payment arrangements, if you're fortunate enough to be able to qualify for these payment arrangements, are based on your income. Now, so your income-based payments can be as low as zero, believe it or not, and still qualify for public service loan forgiveness program.
Okay.
Yeah, I know.
How does that work? So, that seems weird.
I'm telling you, the whole thing is bizarre, all right? But when we're talking about public service loan forgiveness, you know, that's the one where you work a job that qualifies at some nonprofit organization, hospital, whatever, and you work for 120 consecutive pay, sorry, they don't have to be consecutive, 120 payments of your student loans. Most people say 10 years, but they don't have to be consecutive. You can come in and out of the program, right? But when you reach 120 payments working for that organization, if you have filed, oh, this is such a bone of contention for me, if you file the proper paperwork every year, which not only requires the application with the government, but something from your employer, all right?
So it has to be refiled every year? You can't just do it once?
Every year.
Okay.
And so many people get to the end, and we've seen it happen. We've done shows about this, where they get to the end and they learn, even though they've worked all that time, they didn't qualify because they didn't file the proper paperwork, and all their loans came falling back on them. Okay. But back to the point, if you file all this proper paperwork, even if your payments are zero because your income is that low, when you reach 120 of those qualified payments, your student debt will be forgiven. Okay, now, I gave you that background to tell you this. What happens if you cannot file the application?
Mm-hmm.
Your student loans don't get forgiven. And what happens when they don't get forgiven? You owe. You owe the student loans, you owe the penalties, you owe the interest, you owe those student loans.
Which puts you back. Is this for everybody after 120 payments? Like everybody gets it forgiven if they fill this out how they're supposed to, or is it specific loans?
Only it's specific loans with the government, right? Your private loans are not eligible, right? These are public loans, federal loans. It's a federal program. And it's if you work in certain jobs that qualify. And this is all on the government website. You can go to studentaid.gov and catch all this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what I see happen here in the office is that many times people will take a job for a nonprofit organization because that job qualifies them for 10 years, if they keep doing for 120 payments, for their student loans to be forgiven. And if their student loans are very expensive, that has real value to them.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying here, and if this sounds a little bit like what we talked about on Social Security, where women are the caretakers and they put less money into the system and it ends up coming home to roost at the end, this is the same sort of thing. If you take that lower paying job, gambling that your student loans will then be forgiven, thereby getting a $300,000 bonus or whatever it happens to be as a metaphoric term, right? Then you have got less earnings, right? You're putting less into the system all across the board.
Mm-hmm.
If your student loans don't get forgiven, you have penalized yourself, or you have been penalized, right? By trusting that the government program is going to work and that this is what the rules of the game are.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the rules. I check the website. I fill my forms out every year. I'm good. I'm on track.
And that's assuming that these government jobs are lower paying than a regular job in that field?
Yes. And most of them are. Most of them are, you know, you're sacrificing something.
Right.
Not always, but you're sacrificing something for that position, in part because you want to give back to society, maybe, right? That might be part of your goal. And in part because you're counting the dollars. You're saying, hey, I can take this job. I don't have to make my student loan because I'm on IDR, income-driven repayment, and my income is low enough that my payments are zero, or they're at least a percentage of my income. So this makes my payments affordable right now, and it gives me the promise of when I've made 120 of those payments, as long as I file my paperwork every year, and my employer files my paperwork or signs my forms, then the rest of my loans will be forgiven. Now, I know a lot of people who are gambling on this, a lot of people.
Well, it seems like it would be worth it if, you know, you make sure that you do everything you're supposed to do.
Yeah. And how do you know what you're supposed to do? Oh, you check the government websites, right? So, what is the problem right now is not so much that the plans, well, it might be that the plans aren't going to be upheld, but we don't know that yet. And therein lies the problem. We don't know much right now. There is a huge lack of information. And that lack of information is causing about 8 million borrowers, at least 4.5 million with these repayment plans, to wonder what the heck is going on with their student loans. And they're in limbo. Now, a lot of these people have to rely on filling out these forms every year to, as I said, to qualify for public service loan forgiveness. But other people just rely on the forms because they have to fill them out every year to remain in a payment program. Now, if your student loan payments are $1,000 a month and you can't afford that, and your payment program is $200 a month and you can afford that, if you can't file the application, unless the government does come out and say, which they've not yet, if they do come out and say, we're going to extend the timeline for this because we've taken down the applications, a thing we'll talk about here, then you don't know what's going to happen. Your loans could retroactively, basically, right? They could just go back to, sorry, here's your $1,000 payment. And by the way, your interest, your penalties, things like that that might have been forgiven under one of your payment programs or might have been put into forbearance or deferment, those might come due as well. So people are in a frenzy about this. So let me just say that, so we film these shows and then they air and sometimes they're out of sync a little bit. So when we're recording this, today is what is today? March, let's see,
11th.
March 11th. Thank you.
Yes.
March 11th. And on the Friday, just a few days ago, 25 Senate Democrats wrote to the Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, asking for some more information about this. What did your agency do? Now, what is your agency going to do? So what they've done is in February, they made a decision to pull this application down off the website. When they pulled the application down for income-driven repayment plans, that also prevented millions of borrowers from filing that application for other kinds of income plans, like the repay, the save, all these sort of government, we love to give them these acronyms, all these plans. So what happens is that those payments will suddenly balloon if those applications can't be filed. So 25 Senate Democrats wrote and said, could you just give us more information? As
Did
far
they
as we
also
know,
write, P.S. Can I meet the Rock?
did they also write what?
Can I meet the Rock?
Well,
Thank you for
maybe
getting my
more.
joke. Thank you for understanding my joke.
Oh, yeah. Maybe more than that wrote for that. Who knows who's interested in this? But certainly, if you have a student loan or you're a parent with someone with a student loan, you're interested in it. So the thing is that, borrowers have relied on these payment programs for decades. Many of them are really close because they've been around for decades, right? Many of them are really close to having their loans forgiven. And so this is considered to be a very sudden move, and a fairly reckless move. With all these borrowers, millions of borrowers in the mix. And all people seem to be asking for at this point is some information. I recently flew somewhere and I was reminded when we were in a very turbulent area, the plane is going up and down sideways and people are just hanging on going, wow, this is a lot of turbulence. And I'm muttering under my breath, okay, a little communication would be nice, could you just tell us, hey, this is temporary. Besides, oh, there goes the seatbelt sign, right? So all we're saying here is a little communication would be nice, right? We don't necessarily need to care about the seatbelt sign, but we do need some sort of communication. So that's what we're hoping for here. We can talk a little bit in the second half, of course, about, what's happening, what you can do in the meantime, how long this might last. We don't know, but we'll talk about that.
All right. In the meantime, let's get your phone number.
Sure, it's 413-773-3333.
Or you can go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Rame, right here on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram, and we're talking about the dreaded student loans.
So if you're gambling, then you need to think of it as a gamble. You need to have a plan B. I don't like saying that. I would prefer to say, look, we voted this in, that's how it goes, and everybody gets grandfathered. But if only life were that simple. But it's not that simple. So what we're talking about here is a lack of information from the Department of Education.
Well, it might be a lack of education, too. just saying.
Is that a Freudian slip? I don't know.
I'm gonna get us banned here. Okay.
A lack of education from the Department of Information. I like that. Yeah. So that'll get quoted somewhere and I'll be in trouble.
Yeah.
Anyway, they pulled these applications in February. All right. Mm-hmm. And so they shut down their online application portal, which means that the income-driven repayment plans can't be recertified. People can't do their applications. So, and those are plans that are based on earnings, right? But there are also other plans that this hindered, such as, let's see, income-based repayment, income contingent repayment, pay as you earn. All right. So those borrowers, there's one piece of information that has come out from the Department of Education so far. One piece. And here it is. They can still request a normal forbearance from their servicers, but interest will accrue while their loans are paused.
What does that mean in real people language?
That means you can still send a paper application in saying, I can't afford my payments, and ask for forbearance, which means a stay of execution on your payments in real people terms, right?
Okay.
But the interest on those loans will continue to accrue. It will continue to amass. And so for all that time that your loans are paused, here's another problem we're talking about. For all the time that those loans are paused, if they are unsubsidized loans, which accrue interest, that means that interest is going to be on there. So by the time your loans come off of the pause, you will owe what you owed plus the interest.
All the interest, yeah. And that kills you.
It does really harm people because it's compounded interest, right? It's not like, hey, if you owed $100,000, you owe $3,000 for the year at 3%. It continues to build, right? Okay. So when they stopped, so there was a thing that the Washington Post reported that said the Education Department sent out this memo to the student loan servicing people. So these are people who are either helping people, you know, figure out how to pay their loans, or to the people who are paying them themselves. But they sent it out saying, stop accepting or processing any pending IDR, income-driven repayment applications, for 90 days. So they not only pulled the application down off the site, they sent a memo out that said, hey, stop, right here. No more processing or accepting any applications for 90 days. There were about, guess how many applications were in process at that point, Jess?
I mean, it's probably going to be hundreds of thousands, right?
1 million.
Wow.
About a million applications in process. So these people are really stuck in limbo. They have filled out their form, but they don't know what's happening with their form. And nothing is happening with their form. So, boy, you know, I don't know what else to say about this, except that this reaction of taking down the application off the website and sending this memo was in response to the federal appeals court, ruling which upheld and extended or expanded Biden's SAVE plan, that S-A-V-E, SAVE plan, which several Republican-led states fought against. They actually sued to end that, right? So we have this lockhorn of Republican-Democrat, Republican-Democrat. We have Republican-led states saying, we don't want those programs, stop doing that. And we got Democrats writing letters saying, we need information here, right? I don't care if you're an alien, and I don't mean an illegal alien, I mean one from outer space. This is not kind to students, okay?
Right.
On either side. You have to, if you're not going to give them these payment programs, at least tell them you're not going to give them these payment programs.
And there's not even a timeline either where they say, like, look, we're getting everything in order. It's a new administration. In 3 months, we'll have an answer for you. It's just kind of open-ended.
Well, that's what people are asking for. They're saying, could we get some basic information? How long will this last? Who will it affect? What can we do in the meantime? And that doesn't seem to be forthcoming at this point. Now, here's one of these things you can say that isn't political on either side. It just is. When the access to these online applications were blocked, it blocked all income-based applications, which were not included in that litigation. So there's litigation, there's a federal appeals court ruling, there's people that are upset about that, and so in response, they pull down the application, which was for the SAVE program, but it was also for all those other income-driven repayment programs that I just listed, income contingent, income based, and the pay-as-you-earn. So how is that fair to those people?
I was going to say before we went to break, and you kind of brought it up in this half, this is all going to end up in court. So at least we know the judges won't be unemployed because there's going to be so many court cases in regard to this, I can imagine.
Well, it's still in court. And there's only one group I can think of that is okay for the moment on income-based, and that's the SAVE people, right? Biden's SAVE plan, if they currently have their loans in an interest-free forbearance plan, while the litigation continues, they don't need to update their income until 2026.
Okay.
And I'm checking, if you're watching me read, I'm checking my notes here. There was a great article on Yahoo Finance where I got some of this information, and it's they did a great job explaining this. But what they're explaining is what I'm explaining too, which is we can't explain anything. Because we don't know.
Have the information,
This is 30 minutes of empathy to the students because, oh, I know, we have too much empathy, right? But I feel bad for students who are trying to play by the rules that were given to them.
So if you have someone calling you who's a student who's in the middle of this, what's your advice? What are your tips for them? Can you have any? I mean, you don't have any information.
You know, the best tip I can give you is to go to studentaid.gov, who is always in the know, right? And they had one tiny little memo at the top that just said, I forget what it was. It was small. But I think it said, you know, that it's paused for 90 days. And I don't know, if you go to studentaid.gov, you'll find it. But it wasn't much. It was... That's the thing that I'm thinking about that was stop accepting and processing applications. I think that's what the memo said. We can't accept or process for 90 days. But, you know, that was February. 90 days will come quickly. And what a mess. I don't know. I don't know if these loans are going to be, you're going to have 3 months worth of interest on your unsubsidized loans that will be on there. I don't know if the government will come out and say, no, we just extended it and you're not going to have to pay any of that. And we're just picking up where we left off. I don't know if they're going to come out and say, what do I say? We don't care that the federal court appeal upheld this. We don't like it. And so we're not going to do it.
I wonder if this will deter to like continuing education. Like if you're looking at all of this or your parents are talking about it and you're in high school right now, do you want to go to college and take this all out and know that you're going to be in limbo like this? So does it deter that at all? I wonder if that goes into thinking or even when I know you've gotten to talk at schools and stuff before, but even when the counselors are talking to kids about this stuff, they don't have any information really to tell them.
Well, I mean, you always bring up the most logical point. I know you tell me you're not an expert in finance or whatever.
I'm just thinking from like a regular person, you know?
But that's the point. The reason that you make a great co-host is because you think like a regular person and you remind me when I'm too technical or when there's something like a mom. I mean, you're a mom.
Yeah.
And you think like a mom, right? And you're a news director. You think like a news director, right? So, I think it is very difficult. If this were to go on long term, I think it would have an overlying effect, right? Or an underlying effect. But I think even short term, if this is affecting you, if this is happening at the time that you are trying to fill out your paperwork,
right?
It's affecting your decisions right now. And people just don't know what to do. And in the midst of all of this, we have all of these firings going on, you know, across the board. And so we got people who are working in organizations that are government related, who are in public service loan forgiveness, who not only can't file their paperwork, they don't know if they're going to have a job, right?
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry,
but
yikes.
For people to process the paperwork if it starts back up, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, what about the people that have been fired that are now filing suits, hoping they're going to go back to their position? How are we ever going to unravel all of this? What a mess.
Yeah, it really is. And we talked about this a little bit at the beginning, but it is changing like all the time. I'm just thinking about on a different topic, the tariffs. That's like every hour it's something different. So, I mean, I guess with the Department of Education, it's like you're saying at least some information would be better than nothing. Like we're really not getting anything right now.
Well, you ask me, what can I say to people? And typically I never give you a problem without giving you a solution. And
right.
I can't give you a solution yet. But what I can tell you is I'm staying on top of it. If you want not to be glued to a television set or have studentaid.gov on speed dial, you know, then you, does anybody use speed dial? Is that a real thing anymore? You know what I mean? If you don't want to have their site open all day, then, you know, you can reach out to us and we will have the skinny as soon as it's out there on whatever can be done, because we help people with student loans. It's part of what we do. Student loans are debt, right? And so between the budgeting and the student loans and the retirement portion, we help people with all of that. And I don't like coming to the airwaves and saying, I don't have a solution yet, but I do want to say that, you know, we are here to help, even if it's just to tell you, hey, when we get news, we'll reach back out to you.
And right, so and that, at least you're like on top of scouring all the different sites and different places to be able to find the latest to be able to give people. I mean, there might be people out there that didn't even know that these applications are on pause for 90 days.
Well, there really might be a lot of people probably, right? I mean, there's a million applications on pause. That's not so many when you think about the population of the United States, but it's a million people still.
Right, right.
You know, not all of them are tuned into the television or paying attention to this. And it's not, I don't think this story is at the forefront. I mean, you're not turning on the TV and bam, student loan thing, right? I always try to bring things that maybe you haven't heard about or that will affect you. And this is one of those times. So I hope that even telling you, hey, this is going on, bringing awareness and saying there needs to be some resolution. You want to write to your congressman, you want to check with anybody, you can do that and see what you can do to find out about your own situation and maybe help some others as well. And I certainly hope it gets resolved soon. Yeah.
So interesting. All right. Well, let's get your phone number if anybody has questions. And I'm sure there's a lot of questions.
I'm almost afraid to give it. Okay. 413-773-3333. And I'm kidding. You can call us anytime.
And you can go to hugyourmoney.com anytime as well. Thank you so much. We'll
Thank
be back
you,
again
Jess.
Next week with another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. Have a great week.
Thanks. You too. Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Hug Your Money. So unique, it's patented. Financial coaching and more information at hugyourmoney.com.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
Hi, it's Francis. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe, and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Financial literacy and the human condition. Welcome to Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raham.
Hi, it's Francis. I just wanted to take a minute to thank you for watching this video. If you're catching us on YouTube, please help us help others by clicking like, subscribe and all notifications so you don't miss any videos. And check back for the next video. I think you're going to love it. Thanks again. For more information, you can visit us at hugyourmoney.com.
Welcome to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the money doctor, Dr. Francis Ram. Hi.
Hey, Jess, how are you?
I am good. And we have a guest, which I always love when you bring someone on.
We do. We have Jocelyn King with us, backed by popular demand. She's from Smarter Online Safety. And boy, I just loved having her. She's so full of information and the kind of information that we need right now about keeping our accounts safe online and just living a little safer, considering the fact that everybody knows how to click a link these days, including the criminals. So yeah. Welcome, Jocelyn.
Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to be here.
Our pleasure. Our pleasure. So, she's been clandestined in the side room with the headphones on while we decided what we're going to ask her about on our little cybersecurity game show here. Truly, she has no idea what these questions will be, but she's a good egg and always will, come on and talk to us about this. So, I would like to get a little background because, it is true that people, even people who listen to podcasts a lot, may not really understand online safety. People think, well, as long as I don't click the link in my email, I'm okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So can you give us a foundation of maybe some of the top things that people don't understand that they should be aware of in terms of protecting their bank accounts or their personal information online?
Absolutely. The world of hackers and cybercrime is continually evolving, and they're getting smarter about online crime, and that's why we named the company Smarter Online Safety, because we all need to get smarter about our safety when we're online and offline. But of course, we're focusing on the cybersecurity world. And what really happens is most people think, okay, as long as I'm, well, actually, there's a lot of people who still are clicking links in SMS texts that are suspicious and phishing emails. I will say over 80% of attacks come from clicking on links. And it sounds fairly obvious, like, oh, there's a link, I shouldn't click on it. But if you're getting an email or a text from who you think is your boss's boss or your uncle or your child or something, and it has an urgent message in it, I think the foundational thing to know about cyber criminals is they rely on getting you into a fear state. When you get into fight or flight, you lose your ability to think with your prefrontal cortex, which is our higher human brain that helps us make smart decisions. And they can get us out of that in a second by making us feel that our teenager's in trouble or our mother, who's maybe starting to show early onset, signs of Alzheimer's or something, is saying something's going on and we have to help. And that getting that bias for action that we have to do the right thing is what hackers rely on to manipulate us into taking the wrong action that will benefit them. So just think that it's number one, whether it's a link or a phone call or anything, if you, first of all, trust your gut, first of all. Rarely do I talk to somebody who had zero spidey sense or gut feel that something might be wrong. So if you think that at all, stop, take a beat. The other thing is, we have a saying in cybersecurity called zero trust. Okay, so zero trust means you assume you can't trust anyone and you verify everything. And by doing that, you won't accidentally click on something that is seemingly innocuous, because they are getting better and better. It's more likely you're going to get an email you think is suspicious, almost from a friend than from a hacker, because hackers, really good ones, have gotten so good at imitating your real friends. They've downloaded everything about you on your Facebook account and your friend's account. So they're talking to you and they're using AI tools to mimic the language. Everybody who's learning about AI, you learn that you can mimic anyone's voice and cadence, and you can mimic their language choices and things. So you can ask an AI to put things in Francis's, how would Francis say this? And then text it to Jess, and it's going to sound like Francis. And that's the day and age we're living in. Okay. So I think, first of all, you have to I don't say trust but verify. I say be suspicious and verify.
Yeah, it's gone way beyond. Oh, it's gone way beyond spoofing. I'm sorry, Jess, go ahead.
It's okay. I just was going to say, I think also in addition to the panic text you get, something has happened, like you've got to bail somebody out or whatever, where you click on it. We're also busy in our regular lives, and we're now available 24/7 to bosses and everyone else, which is a problem. So if you're doing other things, you're getting dinner ready for the kids, you're, you know, finishing up work stuff, and you get an email in, chances are you can click it, not because you're not being smart, but because you're busy and there's a million things going on.
Right, right. And you're exactly right. And what then, they rely on the busyness. The other thing is a lot of damage being done to your accounts and stuff is happening while you're not online, while you're working, while you're shopping, while you're at the gym, while you're sleeping. Because, you know, I've had some people in my classes who, when they learn, you have to learn how vulnerable you are in order to learn how to protect those vulnerabilities. And in that moment where people realize how vulnerable they actually are, while we're starting to protect them, is when they think, I just want to throw my computer and phone and never get online again. And I say, but that's the worst thing you could do, because all of your, even if you never got online again, it's not just you have to worry about. It's the fact that your social security number, your logins, your password, your information, even if you never opened an account and had a password, it's in all these financial institutions, government agencies that are hacked on a daily basis. And then it's your information sold on the dark web. So the most, like I tell people, stop trying to protect your social security number. And I don't mean put it on a billboard or put it on your Facebook, you know, home screen. But what I mean is stop trying to protect it and focus on how do I make sure it's not being used against me. And that's where you want to make sure you are, for instance, freezing your credit, turning on two-factor authentication. So let's say you're at work and you get an alert that something's going on your account. You could have had, you know, somebody social engineer, a customer service rep at a company. You get, your mobile phone company phone number and login. But from that, they can get information about you that they can then use to hack into your financial accounts or retirement account. And if you suddenly get an alert that one of your financial accounts is being logged into, you know you're being hacked real time and you need to, you know, take action. If you didn't turn on your authentication, if you didn't have your credit frozen, these things would be happening while you're going about your business or sleeping or on or sitting by the pool. And you find out about, some people find out about it months and even over a year later. And that's when you have irreversible damage.
Yeah, but let's point out, taking action does not mean clicking that link, because you will get things that say your account is being hacked. You need to do this immediately. You're getting a delivery and we can't deliver it. Please give us your address. I mean, there's a million of these things that come through. So at the very most basic core, what I tell people is, whatever source you think it came from, you don't touch the message. You call the source on the phone, you call your local bank or you call your local payment company or whoever is sending that to you and say, I got this, I'm suspicious of it. Is there really something going on with my account?
Right. And by the way, I've talked to people who have done that, but they've inadvertently, because again, they're in a fight or flight. In mind, they're calling the phone number that the hacker sent them in the text or email.
Exactly.
Saying, please call us at Bank of X. And then they give the 800 number, but that 800 number is a set up call center by the hackers too. And so you're sort of doing the right thing, but you're getting it from the wrong source. So exactly. Completely exit the phone conversation, the email, or the SMS text, and then go to the known good source. So not everybody's going to have, like if you bank with Bank of America or Chase or whomever, you may not have their phone number already in your phone. So first of all, that's a great thing to do. You got nothing, you know, you're sitting in the doctor or dentist office.
Make sure.
A good time. Add it to your contacts. And then you have the correct one, and then you can call them. But go to the website, and also always go to their actual website and get it. Hackers have also been taking over a lot of sponsored links on Google. So you could get into a hacked site, hasn't been caught yet and taken down, because you're clicking on that sponsored link at the top of Google, Google results, go to the bank, BOFA.com or Chase, .com. Go to the right one and then only get the phone number from there.
Yeah, watch
the address first. Can you ever just ignore it? Like, for example, I keep getting the easy toll one, and everyone's getting them now, where you owe, however much in tolls.
Yeah, then you, you can also block and report. That does help in the background, because when all of us are doing that, it focuses law enforcement and the large companies' attention on those as suspicious, and that's how hackers get taken down faster, or their site.
I hit the delete and report junk all the time, but I still get them. So can I ignore it? Can I just ignore it?
You can. And I would recommend, if you're going to ignore it, I would recommend you also delete it so you don't accidentally. Just like purse dialing, aka butt dialing, and things like that can happen. You never want to accidentally engage. I would recommend you just delete it.
Okay.
Either delete or delete and report. I take pictures of them because then I use them in my trainings.
Perfect. We could add to your collection, I bet.
Exactly. I've had a lot of people send me things and say, "Here, can you tell me about this?" And then I say, "Yes, and may I use this? I'm going to use this." And I take out any personal information, obviously. But
can we get some contact information for you, Jocelyn, before we go to break?
So anybody who wants to learn more about how to be safer online can come to smarteronlinesafety.com, and we've got newsletters and videos and a lot of free stuff and some classes and workshops that you can learn from and protect yourself.
Yeah, I can't wait for our second half to talk more with you about this sort of thing. And I'm sure Jess has questions too, but one of the things that occurs to me is what's going on in the political environment. And when we come back, maybe we can talk a little bit about people's bank accounts and how we might protect things like that.
All right, let's get your phone number, Frances.
Sure, it's 413-773-3333.
And you can go to hugyourmoney.com. We'll be back with part two of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram, on WHMP.
Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor is underwritten by Franklin County Technical School. We build futures. Visit fcts.us or call 413-863-9561.
Welcome back to Financial Fitness. I'm Jess Tyler, along with the Money Doctor, Dr. Frances Ram, and we have a special guest today talking about keeping ourselves safe online.
We do. Welcome back to Jocelyn King from Smarter Online Safety. And, she's just got so much information. I'm sure if she's willing, we'll have her back again. The reason I wanted to talk about this is because people say those things to me. They say, "I won't do online banking because I want to be safe." And I'm saying, look, the horse has left the corral years ago. We used to have our social security numbers on our driver's licenses.
Yeah.
on the driver's license that you handed to everybody. And it's still the same situation. The more information that is out there, the more at risk you are. And you do classes about this that people can sign up for. So can you talk a little bit about, what those classes are like and how easily accessible they are to people so that they could learn?
Sure. So I have a masterclass that just gives the basics in a 2-hour. And in fact, Frances, I'll give you a code so that I'll give you a code that makes it like a $7 class instead of a $97 class for your listeners. And because I'm really wanting people to get safer online. So we'll get you that. But then I also have a half day workshop called, Safer Now. And you can come in and that's the hands on. Because what I recognize is a lot of people, like, for instance, everybody knows they should have complex, passwords and
passwords.
Unique passwords for each one. Yeah. That's great. But then they're like, okay, but how do I do it? Or I keep forgetting it. And most people spend most of their time resetting their password every time they're trying to log in. And then they don't do it. And I understand why. So what I do is I help you actually not just tell you that you should use a password manager, but we actually, it's a workshop. You're sitting there, we're getting it set up. We're putting your most important accounts in. You're generating a new password. We're making sure you're using a new email or an email that's kind of pristine that you don't use for all your junk email newsletters and coupons and all that. so that you are getting safer and your information is not vulnerable. So it's literally a hands-on where you walk through that. We talk about freezing your credit. So some people come in with that done. Other people need to know how to do it. Got a little setup for that. We walk through just the seven things that everybody has to do. So you leave after a half day actually safer and not with a list of things to go do on your own. Because most of us, and I found this too, I mean, I got into cybersecurity because I was targeted by cyber criminals and hacked and lost a ton of money and had my life implode. And when you're in the middle of it or looking at, you know, yeah, I should protect myself. It's like, you should write a trust and a will and you should do this and you and we just keep kicking that can down the road forever. So come in, spend 4 hours, and you get it all done, and you have that sense of relax. I guarantee some people write and they say, oh my gosh, I had the best night's sleep after that, because those things that are weighing on you are, you know, we've taken care of most of them. And most cybercrime is very formulaic. That's what I do. You know, part of my trainings is I have what I call taking the hoodie off the hacker, where I just teach you the basics of how cyber criminals and hackers work, because you know, there are special cases where if you're under personal attack, they will go to great efforts, you know, technologically and personally, and invest a lot of time in nuance trying to social engineer you. But the average person isn't going to experience that. The average person is experiencing what's called a brute force attack, which is just thousands of possible combinations of email logins and passwords and stuff until, you know, until they get lucky, just like, you know, in Vegas, you know. And so most people are under the threat of that. So it's very easy to set things up so that you have incredibly low odds of getting attacked under those conditions. But yeah, ransomware is a real deal. And Lockbit, you know, it's not the first, won't be the last. This it's been getting more and more commercialized. And let me just tell your audience, this is the reason why cybercrime's not going away. For $45, you can get malware and a mentor. Yeah. And they have internships in cybercrime. And so you're getting a mentor, and a criminal just needs a smart device and an internet connection, and they can make $25,000 a month. For $4.99 a month, you can get the AI tool that emulates somebody's voice. That is where Jess could get a call where it sounds like Francis talking to you, and they're typing in what it should, but actually the AI is even telling us, this is Francis would use this word, not that word. A quick story, if you'd like, on how this is happening.
Yeah, because you're creeping me out here.
This is a bit of a thing. Well, this is the reality of what you have to be aware of. This is why I say approach with zero trust. And regardless of whether you should be paying attention to this country or not that country or this organization or not that, just you're never going to know what's coming at you. So just be suspicious. Assume a certain percentage of outreach to you on the phone, in text and emails is going to be hacking. And then you're looking for it. It's a lot easier to start seeing things when you're looking, going, oh, is this one of those that I'm expecting, than it is to just be caught off guard. So the CFO of Ferrari got a phone call from the CEO of Ferrari, who they work with on a daily basis and have for years, saying, I'm with this company. We want to close this deal. I negotiated down to a great price, but we've got to act now. I need you to wire this money to there. Now, what the CEO was asking the CFO was not a completely uncommon thing. They do deals all the time, except the CFO had never heard of this deal before. And every other time this has happened, they've known about the deal. Sure. So the CFO was super smart, and this is where we want to get smarter and do things like this. It said, I'd be happy to. Yesterday I was in your office and you recommended a book to me. What was the title that book?
That's right.
Yeah. And they hung up. Because what it was, but if you can imagine, the CFO of Ferrari believed it was the voice of the CEO. That's how good the AI voice tools are. So you can imagine getting a call from your uncle or aunt that you haven't talked to in however many months and it sounding just like them. So if you know that this could be happening, you get over the surprise part of the attack, so be attacked.
And you're on guard. Yeah, I'd like to take a moment to say that our company doesn't make any any outbound sales calls at all. If you call us, we talk to you. But if you ever get a call that sounds like it's from me, I want you to follow the same guideline we just talked about. Hang up, call me back on my real line and tell me, you know, hey, I just got a call from you. Because it's a very simple thing. It's like, don't click the link, right? It's a simple thing, but you have to internalize it and do it over and over and over again. That is really creepy. But what you just said, I do also, and Jess probably does too. You get all these things from Facebook or LinkedIn or other places where they say, so-and-so is trying to connect with you. And hey, how you doing? Haven't seen you in a long time. And I do that. I say, if this is I don't mean to be offensive. And I say that. I don't mean to be offensive, but I haven't heard from you in years. And if this is really you, you'll be able to tell me how we met, or you'll be able to tell me what our connection is or whatever. And they never even respond. It's always right. Some hacker, you know?
Right.
And is this
right.
A way of the future, or is there a solution for this? Because this just seems like, honestly, for the average person, just a giant pain. Like every call you get, you gotta worry that it's going to be AI. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and you're not, that's the other thing too, because when I was actually under attack for a long haul cyber crime mm-hmm. thing, I was living living on an adrenaline and cortisol drip for mm-hmm. 2 years mm-hmm. and then it destroyed my health. So I don't recommend you be on that kind of alert. I mean, unless you actually are a soldier, you don't want to be living like you're a soldier right. in mm-hmm. war zone, but you just need to be alert. You know, it's kind of like the way we teach our kids about safety. If they're walking to, you know, three doors down to their friend's house or whatever, you know, you teach them, don't take candy from strangers, don't get in the car. You know, this is what you do if somebody, you know, tries to, you scream and you run or whatever. You know, there's all those things we were taught as kids, and we teach our kids. Well, there's an online version of that. And in fact, that's the biggest thing that I solve. I think one thing that Smart Online Safety is doing is we help you see your online world like mm-hmm. the same way you see your device. So see your devices as your doors of your online house. See your you see your accounts and your password as the windows. And see your Wi-Fi router as your garage door. This is what we teach in the workshop. So you're literally having this online house model, and you're writing down your account, because once you see something, you can protect it. It's the fact that everything's online and in cyberspace, and therefore seemingly invisible, that you can't protect what you can't see. But the hackers, that's where they live, so they can come at you. So they have an unfair advantage until you start seeing your online house and protecting it the same way you lock up your physical house when you leave.
Yeah, I remember years ago, one of the people that helped us with security with our website, and so one of the things we do is we don't ask for account numbers or social security numbers. I don't want that stuff in our system, even though everything's encrypted. But I just figured it's safer, if we don't need it, to not ask for it online, right? Mm-hmm. But I remember this time when I got a call from him. Now, he was a government security specialist in Europe, and in a 24-hour period, he saw something like 385 attempts to get to our site from different servers. But he caught it immediately because he had handwritten a script to do that, to catch that. You know, we were down for less than 24 hours and back up again. But that had to be 15 years ago. I was always grateful to him for catching that. And I also thought, well, what could they have gotten? Not very much. We still have that model today where we don't ask for those things. I wish that more places did that.
The interesting thing about that, and I just did an episode on this on my Smarter Online Safety podcast too, where I had an expert on and we were digging into it. But the point is that the reason people ask why do you need to give your veterinarian your social security number? What does that possibly have to do?
Yeah.
But it goes back to, these are really archaic models. I used to build databases back in the day, and the unique identifier people back in the day was a social security number. So they would ask for it so that you had a unique record guaranteed, because nobody else would have your social security number. But some of those, it's like, you know, they're still being used, even though most of them have a way to give you a unique customer ID. So what I've done, and I've been doing this for years, you know, on that form where you fill out, and you're supposed to hand print your your social security number. And when you're sitting in a doctor's office, I just leave it blank. And well, I'll wait for them to ask me, and they never ask me for
they
it.
They never do.
So,
exactly.
So you're just giving it away. And here's the other thing, never write anything down. I'll tell you, I was signing up with a new mobile carrier for my cell phone. And over the phone, they're asking me for my social security number. And I can hear all the, I know they're in a call center offshore. Yeah. And I said, well, no, I don't give that out. And I suddenly got suspicious. And I said, I need to call you back. What is my ticket number? And I'm going to call, I need to call you back. I didn't say why. I didn't say, I don't trust you or whatever. But I thought, oh my God, this might be a voice phishing call.
Right.
So I hung up and I called back into the main line. Got through, gave my ticket number, and it was actually this large mobile carrier asking me for my phone number. Now, anybody on an overseas, call center can be sitting there with a pad and pen and writing all these social security numbers down and walking out and make more money selling those later on the dark web than they did in their whole day of work at the mobile carrier. So that's what I don't like about it. I actually sent an email to the head of online security at that company talking about my background and cyber and that they need to change this. And we're actually talking and I'm actually going to be helping to train some of their employees now because this is prevalent, but don't give out your social security number unless it's a government agency or a financial institution. You have to, and then do it knowing that it's being captured in a secure way where other eyes can't see it.
Yeah, always great information from you. Jess, do you have any further questions for Jocelyn?
I mean, I have a million questions, but we're out of time. So
we are.
It's just really interesting, and you have to be hyper aware, and it's hard because we're doing so many other things to have to focus on this. But the other option is going through like what you went through, which was 2 years of your life that were ruined because of this. So
and half a million dollars. Yeah.
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 $1 million.
Yes.
Let me get a phone number if people want to give you a call to find out more or to maybe take one of the online classes.
So actually, we're changing our we've had some issues with security with phone services that we've been looking at. So I want people to come to smarteronlinesafety.com and engage with us there. And you can sign up for the classes. I'll get later today. I will get you that code, Francis, so you can share that with your listeners. And
that would be
just everybody just stay suspicious, protect yourself and just a little, just get a little smarter and everything's going to be okay.
Francis,
stay safe out there.
Can I get your social, Francis, please?
Oh, absolutely. My social security number. Sure. Let's just give that to everybody. It's already out there anyway. Let's see. It's 413-773-3333. Yeah, that's it.
All right. Might be the phone number if you have any questions to get a hold of Frances. She will not give you her social for sure. You can also go to hugyourmoney.com and hopefully everybody goes there today. Thank you both. This was really interesting.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jess. We'll be back next week with another edition of Financial Fitness with the Money Doctor, Dr. Francis Raymond on WHMP.